Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 22nd, 2026, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on Boast versus Illinois Board of Elections, which was decided last week by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve, so I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Jason Torchinsky, who is a partner at Holtzman, Vogel, Barron, Torchinsky, and Josepak, the LLC, specializing in campaign finance, election law, lobbying disclosure, and issue advocacy groups. In addition to his practice counseling clients on compliance with campaign finance, ethics laws, lobbying disclosure, and election laws, Mr. Torchinsky has served as lead counsel in a number of litigation matters and frequently lectures on campaign finance, redistricting, and ethics-related subjects, and provides commentary to the media on election-related matters. Prior to joining the firm, Mr. Torchinsky was counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division at the United States Department of Justice. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's program is Hans von Spakovsky, who serves as a Senior Legal Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Institute for the Rule of Law at Advancing American Freedom. His interests and expertise include a wide range of legal and constitutional issues, including civil rights, elections, the First Amendment, immigration, executive authority, the rule of law, and government reform. He is the former Senior Legal Fellow and Manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and a former member of President Donald Trump's Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. 2006-2007, Mr. von Spakovsky was a member of the Federal Election Commission, and he has also served as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice from 2002 to 2005. And I'll leave it there. A last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. von Spakovsky, the floor is yours.
Well, welcome to the program, everyone. Again, I'm Hans von Spakovsky, and I'm very happy to welcome Jason Torchinsky here. You got his bio, I should say. However, we are old friends and colleagues. In fact, more than two decades ago, am I allowed to say that, Jason? We had offices across the hall from each other in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Justice Department. And I kept working there when Jason actually abandoned me to go over and become the Deputy General Counsel for the Bush-Cheney Re-Election Committee in 2004. And I did have to say, Jason is very well known. If you have a case before the FEC, a case involving lobbying, election issues, anything like that, you know, Jason is one of the partners at Holtzman Vogel that people go to for advice and counsel on these kind of issues. Jason, this was a really important case. Bost obviously was Michael Bost, the Republican congressman in Illinois, one of the few Republican congressmen in Illinois. I think he represents the 12th congressional district. And he, and I think two other candidates actually sued the Illinois State Election Board. Illinois is one of those states that has a state election board running elections rather than a secretary of state. And they were contesting the law in Illinois, which allows ballots to be counted that come in for up to 2 weeks after election day. But when he tried to assert that claim, saying that it violated federal law, why don't you tell folks what happened to him in the courts and then what the Supreme Court actually said about it. We just got the decision within the last, two or three weeks, one of the first really important decisions the court has released.
Yeah, I mean, this case is really interesting because it's actually a part of what I think of as a two-case series in front of the court this term for election law. So let's go through Hans's question, Hans's immediate question first, which is what happened was, you know, Congressman Boston, actually two presidential electors challenged Illinois' rule that allowed absentee ballots that are received after Election Day to be counted. And Hans is right, they had quite an extended period of time before the ballots were allowed to kind of had a deadline. The district court...
I think that's the longest period of any state in the country allowing ballots to come in after Election Day.
I think that's right. And so what happened was the district court and the Seventh Circuit both found that the congressman and the two electors lacked standing to bring the suit, and the court agreed to hear the case. But I think, you know, you have to put Boston in context. It's a procedural case about who has standing to challenge an election law. Boston did not actually look at the question of whether the post-election absentee ballot deadline is in fact consistent with federal law. That case is the sort of companion to this case, as I think of it, is heading to the Supreme Court in a different case that's going to be heard later this year and will likely be decided by June. In that case, the Republican National Committee challenged Mississippi's post-Election Day ballot return deadline. The district court upheld it. The Fifth Circuit reversed it and said no. That case is Watson v. Republican National Committee. It's not yet scheduled for argument. It is widely expected to be argued before the end of this term, but it hasn't been calendared. So I want to go back through what Bost ultimately did, but it's important, particularly when we think about Justice Jackson's dissent, to put it in context of what she knows is coming down the pike in this area. So the result was Congressman Bost didn't have standing to maintain his lawsuit. The court, you know, by the way, the court declined to address presidential elector standing, which is interesting, but the decision was actually 7-2 for Congressman Bost, resulting in three opinions. But the court was clear, you know, between the seven, all seven agreed that Boss had standing to challenge the absentee ballot return deadline and frankly should have been allowed to do so in advance of 2024. So what happened was that the court split actually into three opinions. The opinion for the court was authored by Chief Justice Roberts, and he was joined by Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. A concurring opinion was written by Justice Barrett, which was joined by Justice Kagan, and then Justice Jackson dissented, and she was joined by Justice Sotomayor. So I want to go through each of the opinions before we take questions. So the first one was the majority opinion. The chief wrote a relatively short and concise opinion concluding that candidates have a special interest in laws that govern their elections. You know, as we've seen from the chief in election law cases in general, he is very interested in clear rules and certainty of process. We've seen cases like Rucho, where the chief worked to keep the court out of political gerrymandering. He looked at, you know, we can think about the cases that he's written that have upheld the Purcell principle, where the federal courts are instructed not to disrupt election cases or election rules close in time to elections. And he's really expressed concerns over and over again about judicial involvement in the post-election processes. Here, what he concluded was candidates have a special interest in the rules that govern their elections and that they have the ability to challenge those rules before the election results hang in the balance. The opinion is actually pretty sensible and I think is going to go a long way towards allowing candidates to bring challenges early in the election process so they can be adjudicated further out from Election Day. I think adjudicating these cases further out from Election Day is going to help ensure that, you know, kind of judges or others who wear robes aren't going to be seen as deciding elections while votes are you know, being held and being tabulated and results are pending. Justice Barrett had an interesting concurring opinion.
Before you go into Barrett's thing, I just want to point out to people, I mean, it's mostly lawyers, you know, watching this, but we also have folks who are not lawyers. And we should just, I think, quickly point out that when the district court and the Seventh Circuit said that a Republican elected member of Congress didn't have standing, what they were saying was that, you know, standing is a requirement. You have to show some kind of concrete injury. And, you know, when I was talking to folks about this case, I had almost a uniform reaction to it. But folks kept saying to me, well, if a candidate doesn't have standing to contest a particular election rule, I mean, who would? I mean, that was the reaction I I kept getting. And the other thing is, weren't you encouraged by how broad that majority opinion was in this case? Because it seems to me the main justices, the five justices, they recognize that you have an injury, even if a rule you're contesting, well, maybe it won't change the outcome of the election, but it could hurt your reputation. It could cost you money. It could hurt public confidence in the outcome of the election if there was a variance from particular rules or regs. Weren't you encouraged by how broad that standing argument was that the court was making?
I was. And I was, because when you look at what the argument the defense was making, which was obviously the state board, the state had a really interesting sort of idea that they were pushing for the justices. They basically were arguing that there had to be a substantial risk of loss before a candidate could challenge an election rule, which is crazy, right? And this is where, you know, the chief really kind of went after the defense counsel here and basically said, look, what you're asking us to do is put the judges in positions of deciding whether a particular law or rule or procedure puts a candidate at a substantial risk of loss. And Justice Roberts, just like he did in Rucho, said, look, I'm not going to put judges in the position of being the adjudicator of political questions that political scientists and pollsters struggle mightily to answer and often get wrong. I think there was actually a reference in the opinion to Dewey and election pollsters. So yeah, it was broad. And you know, we often see in election cases, what you often see is, particularly when you see challenges from the left, you often see some advocacy group alleging overall standing on behalf of their members who are voters. And they have a really hard time articulating how an individual voter might be harmed by a late returned ballot. A candidate is in a very different position with respect to that late returned ballot, right? The candidates, right, if you think about post-election poll watching, keeping your staff on for a period of time after the actual election day, making sure that you've got, you know, people engaged through, I mean, I've seen these vote counts go through the Thanksgiving holiday. Good luck trying to get volunteers to hang around for Thanksgiving week to go stand in polling centers. So the court, the majority and the chief in particular, really recognized that, look, candidates should be able to challenge this, right? If there's a problem, if there's a constitutional or statutory problem with an election, it really is the candidates that should be able to challenge it.
Yeah, I also thought it was very interesting that they mentioned the mandate issue, right? They were talking about the fact that, well, yeah, maybe a particular election rule that is a problem might not cause the candidate to lose the election, but if in fact it causes him to have less votes than he should have gotten if the rule was a proper rule, then that reduces the mandate he's received from the voter. I thought that was also very insightful by the five members who wrote that opinion.
Yeah, and just to give you an idea of the numbers, Congressman Boss in particular has won that district with 70-something percent of the vote consistently. And essentially what the chief said was, look, but what if these late return ballots break 2-1 for his opponent? And instead of winning with 74% of the vote, he wins with 61% of the vote. He looks a lot sort of weaker than he did, right, you know, before the last election. So there was some discussion of, you know, kind of how candidates are directly affected by these laws, right? Even if it changes their victory margin, but doesn't cost them victory, the chief said, look, they should still have an ability to challenge it. And even if the person is going to lose, they should still have an ability to challenge it, right? I mean, what if it was the difference between losing by 49%, where you might have a good argument to run again 2 years later, or losing by 42%, where the argument to run again 2 years later may be harder? So the court was really sort of open to the idea that candidates really are harmed by these things. Justice.
So I interrupted you. And so, yeah, now talk about the concurrence in the judgment by Baird and Kagan. But they didn't like the standing rules that the majority came up with.
Yeah, Justice Barrett and Justice Kagan had a different take. What Justice Barrett said was essentially that the monetary expenditures that Congressman Boss needed to make for this post-election period and needed to spend on this post-election strategy was really what gave him standing, right? It was the need to spend money that really sort of gave him the standing. The majority sort of rejected that and said, look, what if he staffed it with volunteers? Does he no longer have a harm? Like, he actually has to spend a dollar in order to have standing here, and essentially sort of criticized her view, because she's, and the majority basically said, look, we've never really sort of had almost a, you know, kind of a monetary requirement like that to get into court on a constitutional question. So the majority really dismissed Justice Barrett's view, but, you know, both Justice Barrett and Justice Kagan did concur in the judgment. The dissenting opinion was interesting. It was written by Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor. And keep in mind, this is in the context of what they know is coming down the road in the Watson case that's coming up. And I think that's important context here, right? If you think about kind of the right and the left, it's oftentimes the left that sort of says, you know, we need to expand access to the courts. So it's sort of interesting that Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor, two of the most perceived left-wing justices on the court, want to shut the courthouse doors to candidates.
Right.
They basically said, we're departing from our precedent. We're creating this special rule for candidates, so candidates can always bring a challenge to a law, and it's just going to result in this flood of election law cases. Now, I don't know where she's been since the 2000 election. The courts have been flooded with election law cases since the 2000 presidential election. Anyway, you know, oftentimes it is advocacy groups that bring them. There were some changes in campaign finance law over the last couple of years that have actually allowed the candidates and parties more access to funding to bring challenges. So you've seen, particularly since President Obama signed a change in the campaign finance law in 2015, where the political party committees now have access to essentially legal dollars that they really can't use for other things. You've seen the political parties play more of a role in either being plaintiffs or in funding these cases. But the notion that somehow this standing rule is holding back a flood of election law cases is, I was sort of laughing when I was reading the opinion. I was like, really?
Yeah, look, I was too. I mean, can you think of a single case, I couldn't, in which federal judges have denied standing to liberal advocacy groups like the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, the ACLU? They always let them into cases. They seem to always allow them to have standing. I was just kind of astonished at that part of that dissent.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I was sort of reading and thinking, is she kidding? Like, but she wasn't. I mean, but, you know, to her, the idea that a conservative congressman sought to challenge an election law, and she's like, nope, courthouse doors are closed to him. But, you know, and Hans is right, every time an advocacy group comes forward, the advocacy groups get standing because their members are voters, or because they've diverted some sort of, usually it's the standing that the advocacy groups allege is usually one of two kinds. They're either standing in on behalf of their members who have to be their registered voters, or they're arguing that they were forced by this, whatever this law is, to divert resources.
Right.
And that's been the grounds for standing. So I think it's really funny that Justice Jackson sort of rejected Justice Barrett's view that spending money gives you standing, when that's sort of the constant refrain of advocacy groups. And by the way, it's not just in election law cases that advocacy groups claim this diversion of resources. They do it in the environmental space. They do it in all kinds of areas where they claim a diversion of resources gives them, you know, a right to challenge a rule. I mean, even in the Clapper case, which is kind of widely discussed in this opinion, which was the one where people were claiming overseas that the NSA was going to surveil them, and the court rejected their standing because they were like, there's this hypothetical case that you might get surveilled by the National Security Agency, that's not sufficient. But, you know, it is not uncommon, particularly for these advocacy groups, to claim that they had to, you know, divert resources for, you know, like a endangered toad or something that gives them standing in election law cases. And so I thought...
Yes.
Oh, go ahead. I'm so
far. No, finish that. Let me ask you a question then. Well, I got the impression, reading Barrett's concurrence, I got the impression that unlike the other five justices in the majority, that she really doesn't understand the practicalities of elections and how campaigns are run. I mean, do you think that was a wrong impression? Because that seemed to me the what led to her writing that concurrence the way she did. Do you think I'm wrong about that?
You know, I think it's really interesting. I mean, of everybody on the court, all of the current members of the court, the one who's had the most real election law experience or lived elections is actually Justice Alito. For those of you who don't know this, Justice Alito's father was the director of legislative services for the New Jersey legislature. And there's actually a Supreme Court case from the 1980s called Karcher versus Daggett, where if you look down in the footnotes, there's a quote from an affidavit that Sam Alito Sr. submitted to the district court, which I think is kind of funny. Wow. But Justice Alito grew up around elections and elected officials because his father worked for the state legislature. So, you know, I think it's interesting that Alito joined the opinion that seems to understand the perspective of the candidates perhaps better than the two concurrences and the two dissents. I really think in any, this is true in other election law cases and in redistricting cases, Justice Alito seems to have a more sympathy and a better understanding of sort of the position of candidates and elected officials, I think perhaps better than anybody else who sits on the court. So I suspect he influenced parts of the way the chief wrote things, just because he's got that sort of intuitive understanding of what it is to live around campaigns.
Right, right. Do you think in the long run it's going to make any difference in finding standing, particularly for candidates, the difference between what the majority said and the concurrence written by Barrett and that Kagan joined in? Is it going to have a practical effect?
So I think the practical effect is very minimal because, let's face it, these days candidates are spending money, right? I mean, if a candidate, the candidates are constantly spending money on their campaigns, whether it's for staff, whether it's for rent, whether it's for cars or gas to get people out to the polling places or the vote counting centers. There's almost always, with the exception of perhaps very small, like school board races where you may not spend a lot of money, candidates, particularly federal candidates, are constantly spending money. So if you think of the Venn diagram, right, you sort of have the Chief Justice Roberts circle of like anytime there's a candidate, and then you've got the Justice Barrett piece where, well, you know, as long as they're spending money, they get standing. It's hard for me to conceive of the candidate who isn't spending money, again, except perhaps in a very localized race that has, you know, 1,000 voters, like a school board election. Candidates are constantly spending money.
Right. Now, the court, as you said, this was the procedural issue. The court says, yeah, Vost had standing, and they obviously remanded the case down to the lower courts. But I'm actually kind of assuming, are the lower courts you think they're just going to stay further proceedings in the case because the substantive issue, that is whether or not state laws that allow absentee ballots to come in after Election Day, allow them to be counted, that's whether that violates the federal statutes that set Election Day as the first Tuesday after the first Monday in September. That substantive issue is before the court in that Mississippi case. So yep. Is a lower court going to just stay in Illinois because this is already before the Supreme Court, you think?
I mean, if I were the defense in that case, I would certainly ask the district court to stay it. I certainly would. If you go to the National Conference of State Legislatures, if you want to explore the substance, the National Conference of State Legislatures actually has a nice map that shows you across the country what states, you know, what the deadlines are for absentee ballots. Right. So if you just like Google NCSL absentee ballot deadlines, they've got a map and a chart. It's about 20 something states that actually allow ballots to come in after Election Day. Some of those are vestiges of when we had there's a federal statute about military and overseas voters. And oftentimes when they had runoffs too close in time to general elections, one of the remedies that DOJ would seek was an extension of time for the overseas ballots to come in. And so a number of states extended their deadlines to allow the overseas ballots. And then at the same time they did it, they also extended their deadlines for the absentee ballots. And the other context to remember is, you know, these absentee ballot deadlines, you know, if you go back to the 1980s, nearly every state required that you have an excuse to vote absentee, meaning right. You had to be, you know, outside of your jurisdiction or out of the state for the duration of election day. And you had to essentially swear out an affidavit under penalty of perjury that you were gone. And what's happened is, as states have expanded what we call no excuse early voting, you know, states have not necessarily aligned all of their other laws. So, for example, you know, if you think back to the 1980s, when very few people were voting absentee, if a handful of ballots came in after Election Day, it was very unlikely to change the result, particularly of something like a federal election. Well, now when you have no excuse absentee balloting, and there are some states where a third to half of voters will vote absentee, and you're waiting for the Postal Service to drop ballots off, you know, the Saturday after Election Day, just to see if it might change the outcome, because now instead of a handful of ballots trickling in after Election Day, it could be hundreds of ballots trickling in after Election Day. The whole regime was not really thought through when they extended these absentee ballot deadlines. Again, a lot of these extensions that were there were not done in the context where a substantial number of voters are voting absentee. I think there's either three states or five states that still require an excuse, but it's not that many anymore. And states have really right. not comprehensively looked back at their election laws. Now, I think when we get to Watson, I think Justice Jackson will have a very different view, perhaps of whether even the Republican National Committee was harmed by Mississippi's extended absentee ballot deadline. She might find no standing there again. But I do expect that to be a very interesting argument when they get to the merits. I think in addition to the Illinois case, I think there's one or two other of these absentee ballot deadline cases hanging around. But I think most of them are probably going to get held at this point pending Watson.
Right. And we should just mention again, folks who don't know, the law you were talking about that provides overseas American citizens and military members and their families who are posted overseas the right to vote by absentee ballots in federal elections is called UACAV, a Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. Although I don't know if you remember this, Jason, but when we were DOJ, we had a case down in, I think it was Texas.
It was.
Federal judge whose name shall remain nameless, he kept referring to the law as the avocado law instead of the UACAV.
The transcript was great. The transcript of that hearing was great. But you know, and then it was amended by what was called the MOVE Act. And so now they've right. set out some requirements. Now, you know, unlike when Hans and I were at DOJ 20 years ago, the UACAV Act was sort of vague about absentee ballot returns and when you had to mail ballots to overseas voters. What the MOVE Act did, which is the Military and Overseas Voters Act, the MOVE Act clarified that if you have a federal election on the ballot, you must mail your absentee ballots out to your military and overseas voters 45 days out from the election. That allows right. enough time for the ballots to get from the clerk's offices through, in particular, the military mail systems to the people serving overseas, and then get back. The challenge.
Yeah, and plus an important thing was the law provided for international express mail service, for example, at American military bases. So if you are a military member and you're stationed perhaps at one of our big bases in Germany, you can take your ballot that you've completed to base officials there, and they're required by law to send it by international express mail service back to the United States. That was also, I think, a key part of that law.
Yeah. And of course, the other reason for that is, you know, the people at bases in Germany have a much easier time than, say, somebody that's in a field camp in Syria or stationed on an aircraft carrier, where moving mail on and off the aircraft carrier is like the absolute last priority for the Navy, because they have other things they have to move on and off the carriers. So, you know, military and overseas voters were really, for a lot of these extensions, were really the impetus for any kind of extended ballot return deadline. But again, that was in the context of, you know, not a lot of people voted absentee, and those who did were mostly military and overseas. So.
Right. All right. Just one other point, then we'll open it up to questions from folks. And we should, I think, point out that while the Boss case has been remanded down to the lower courts, the Mississippi case we're talking about, I don't think the Supreme Court, while they've accepted the case, I don't think they've set an argument date yet, have they?
They haven't. They've only calendared out through February, though. So we don't have the dates yet for the arguments for the March and April cases.
Okay. But with arguments that late, we might not get the decision on that case till June, right? And the deadline, which could affect. But the point, of course, is, whatever their decision is, could have a huge effect on the midterm elections this year, right?
Yeah. I mean, with 19 or 20 states having sort of late ballot return deadlines, I suspect if the court upholds the Fifth Circuit opinion, a lot of states are going to have to adjust, one, they're going to have to adjust their guidance to their voters. And two, they may have to adjust their ballot mailing deadlines to allow voters to actually obtain their absentee ballots in time to return them. So there may need to be a bunch of adjustments, but it'll be interesting to see. I suspect some states will ask for another cycle and argue per cell. So there's going to be some interesting post-Watson litigation if the court affirms the Fifth Circuit ultimately.
Right. Okay. I think we're now going to go to questions. And I think to do that, do I have to bring up my chat function? Kyla, I'm not quite sure. How do we get the questions?
I see them. I tapped Q&A. All right. The first question is, I'll read the question. Yeah. Oh, actually, Hans, you should read the question. You're the moderator.
All right. Given the trivial practical differences between the Barrett and majority view in election cases, why isn't the Barrett view preferable? It seems like the majority's loosey-goosey standings will make it much easier for environmental and other activist groups to bring lawsuits. Do you think Bost essentially overrules Clapper? So, well, what do you think about that?
I think the answer is Bost does not overrule Clapper. I think that the court, you know, and Justice Jackson sort of mocks the majority for this, but she's somewhat right. They really did sort of create a special category for candidates here, where they basically said, if you're a candidate in the race, you have a right to bring a challenge to, you know, a constitutional or statutory issue that you have with the election rules under which you are conducting your campaign. It's almost like a per se standing rule that's specific to candidates. I think that's a little harder in the environmental context, because there's, in most of the environmental cases, you don't have that same sort of tie into the rules that people are challenging that you have with candidates who have to comply with these and either comply with or live under the processes and procedures set out in these election rules. So I don't think it overrules Clapper. I do think it, you know, there's a lot of cases where the court has done sort of special things in the election context. For example, there's a doctrine in the election law context called capable of repetition yet evading review. The courts will basically hear cases after elections because there generally isn't enough time to adjudicate them fully through the complete appellate process while the elections are going on. So the court has created a number of sort of special standing doctrines in election cases, and that's a mootness rightness sort of special category that is really only available in election cases. And I think that's kind of what the court did here. Justice Jackson criticizes them for it. You know, could the court have come out Could the majority have come out where Justice Barrett was and said, well, because he's spending money to deal with this thing, it gives him standing? Yeah. And that would have disadvantaged, you know, the candidate for a local office who doesn't have, you know, a lot of resources. I mean, there are local, there's thousands of local offices where people may spend a couple hundred dollars to run and be staffed mostly by volunteers, in large part because there are elections that just don't have a lot of voters. But I think I'm actually comfortable with the court's rule here, because I think it's yet another sort of election specific standing rule.
Yeah, no, and I got to emphasize one of the last points you just made is, you know, when talking about election rules, everybody almost immediately fixates on the presidential elections and things like that. But we literally, the vast majority of elections in this country are small local elections at the state level, school board level. I mean, in some places, I think Texas probably has more elections than almost anything else. So many positions that are elected, and those are races where sometimes it's just a couple of hundred votes, and it's all volunteers. And candidates in those situations might have a pretty hard time demonstrating a financial cost to a particular election rule. And of course, that then also then, Jason, doesn't it, it puts judges in this position of saying, well, yeah, maybe you spent some money, but I don't think it's enough. You didn't spend enough to give you standing. So I actually am very comfortable also with what I think the majority did.
So. Yeah. And again, you know, the argument that the state was putting forward was basically you have to show that you would be subject to a kind of some kind of substantial risk of losing the election in order to challenge it. And the chief said, absolutely not. I'm not going to make judges try to be, you know, pollsters or political prognosticators in order to decide whether somebody could have a case heard in front of them. So, yeah, I mean, to the questioner, yeah, I do think it creates a little asterisk slash exception for candidates, but I think it's very hard. I'm trying to think of another context where there's that kind of set of rules and regulations that apply to a particular individual who might otherwise be denied standing.
Yeah, no. And the, you know, what you were talking about, how the Supreme Court has developed all these special rules that only apply to elections, as you know, that's really true. Obviously, you know, another one is their rule they've developed that if you're suing over some kind of rule that if they say you're correct and it's going to make a substantial change in how the election is administered, even if you are in the right, they're not going to grant you your remedy if you sued too close to election day, and it's going to cause all kinds of problems for election officials and voters to try to get used to that new rule. That's also, I think, kind of unique to election cases.
Yeah, and I mentioned that earlier. That's the, for those of you who are not lawyers on the call, that's the Purcell v. Gonzalez case, or the Purcell principle, as some have started to call it now, which is the idea that, in particular, federal judges shouldn't be changing election rules on the eve of elections. Now, what the eve of elections means has varied and is expanding. And a number of states have actually adopted the same thing too. So when candidates or activists bring challenges in state election laws, even if they're right, a lot of times they're, you know, if they bring their challenge too close in time to an election, the court will say, that's for next time because you brought it too late.
All right. Well, we don't have any other questions from the audience. So I don't know, any final words of wisdom, Jason? You know, the one thing that's really changed since you and I first started in this business a long time ago is election litigation, being an election lawyer, I think used to be kind of a seasonal occupation. And there's been such an explosion of litigation and changes in the rules since then, particularly since the Bush v. Gore decision, that now there's a lot of folks like you and me who do this full time.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, there are, we've got the Watson case coming. We've got a campaign finance case pending at the Supreme Court. I mean, the election law explosion or flood that Justice Jackson thinks she was going to stop if her opinion had been the majority in this case is sort of the flood's already there. I guess that's probably my last comment. The flood of election cases is already present.
All right. Well, I want to thank everyone. Jason, thanks so much for coming on to talk about this case. I'm sure we'll be doing this again because of those other cases involving elections that you just mentioned that are before the court. And I thank the Federalist Society for hosting this discussion.
Oh, wait, I think we have one more question. Somebody just popped a question in.
Oh, yeah. Any prediction as to the substantive issue the court will decide later in the term? Do the deadlines, violate the federal law on that?
Predict the outcome of Watson. Go ahead, Hans, you go first.
Well, I don't know if I want to predict what the court will do, but I do think I know what they should do, which is to say that allowing ballots to come in after Election Day, as established by federal law, does violate that statute. And the reason I say that is, if you look at those statutes have been around for a long time, setting that date for congressional and the presidential elections. There's a reason for that. If you look at the history of it, you find that early in the 1800s, before these laws came in place, states held elections at all these different times. And so we didn't know who was going to be, for example, members of Congress for months because of all the different dates set by the states. And the whole point of putting in this law for federal elections was that we had a date certain at which elections were cast for Congress, and we would know who was going to make up the new Congress. And I think, it's the periods of time are not as long as back then, but to have a state like Illinois say, well, we're going to keep counting ballots for 2 weeks after the official federal election day, I think that's a problem, and I think that violates federal law.
So I would probably just be a little more precise in what Hans said. It's not necessarily that they might even count longer than 2 weeks in Illinois. It's that they're going to accept new ballots that weren't in the hands of election officials at the close of polls on election day that I think is the problematic part. And this is why I think the RNC prevailed at the Fifth Circuit. Basically what they said is, look, the court says election day, right? Or the Congress said election day is the first Tuesday after the first Monday. So when you start accepting ballots up to the third Tuesday, basically that's no longer the election. The election should have been over on election day. And by allowing states to accept ballots later and later and later in the process, you just keep stretching out what should be the election where Congress has set a definitive day for the end of the election. So, I think I'm with Hans. I think that the RNC should win and the Fifth Circuit should be affirmed. Whether the court will get there, I don't know. I hope they do. They took it for a reason. And it'll be interesting to see what they say.
Right. All right. Well, thank you. That was now the last question. Again, Jason, thanks for coming on, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this webinar.
No problem. Thanks, everybody.
I'll jump in here and echo those thanks. I really appreciate you both taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. It was a fabulous discussion. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.